this hour's top stories. Iran's top nuclear negotiator tells Press TV that he is not yet confident a conclusion is possible for talks on the revival of the JCPOA.
We are not still in a position to say that we have a clear answer for them and a clear solution actually for these key issues.
Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says the recent conflict in Gaza highlighted Israel's weakness and the existential threats it faces. Anti-racism protests erupt in the U.S. on the anniversary of the murder of African-American George Floyd by a white police officer. Iran's top negotiator to the nuclear talks in Vienna, Abbas Araghchi, says despite progress made on some key differences, he is still not confident a conclusion is possible. Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA have been engaged in talks to revive the deal since April. Omal Ezgi reports.
The remaining signatories of the nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, enter into a fifth round of talks aimed at reviving the agreement through the removal of U.S. sanctions and a return to full compliance by Iran.
The experts will continue the discussions in the working groups. In the meantime, the European Union, as coordinator, we'll continue the talks with all participants of the JCPOA and separately with the United States in view of finding common grounds for an agreement to take shape.
Iranian lead delegate Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said the difficult issues that still need to be resolved have become less, although decisions must be made on the remaining differences.
We have made some progress on them, but we are not still in a position to say that we have a clear answer for them and a clear solution actually for these key issues. But I'm confident that we would be able to make progress this time and, if possible, conclude the negotiations, which I have to repeat, I'm not confident that it would be possible to conclude the negotiations, but there is the possibility.
Iran has been demanding the removal of all U.S. sanctions, including those imposed under other labels against individuals and entities under the former administration of Donald Trump. Iran has also made it clear it would only come back to full compliance after it has verified the effective removal of sanctions, demands that up until now have not been met. Araghchi says he's seen determination and seriousness by all parties involved to reach a conclusion in the coming days, a prospect that he admits is still not by any means certain. Omal Ezgi, Vienna.
Hezbollah Secretary General Syed Hassan Nasrallah says any aggression against Jerusalem or its holy sites would mean regional war. Mariam Saleh is in Beirut.
Hezbollah Secretary General Syed Hassan Nasrallah gave a televised speech to commemorate the 21st anniversary of the liberation of South Lebanon from the Israeli occupation. May 25, 2000 represents, as Syed Nasrallah noted, the beginning of an era of victories for the resistance in the region. The most significant stance in this year's speech was a warning to the Israelis to keep their hands off Al-Quds and Muslim and Christian holy sites in Palestine.
The resistance in Gaza created a balance where they said any assault on Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds will lead to a military confrontation. The new equation that we need to reach is that if they touch Al-Quds, then there will be a regional war. This means all the resistance movements in the region cannot stand idly by if the holy city and the sanctities are under genuine threat. This is a genuine promise that the people of the resistance in the entire region will not forsake the holy city or the Muslim and Christian holy sites to be destroyed.
The leader of the resistance in Lebanon gave a detailed explanation of why the latest confrontation was exceptional and why its results yielded a victory for the Palestinians and a defeat for the Israelis. Experts believe the many victories for the resistance in Palestine are part of the era of triumph, which began in May of 2000.
All the past wars and victories from 2000 to 2006 in Lebanon to 2008 in Gaza until the last battle were all evidence of the accumulation of achievements for victory of the resistance. Today in Gaza in 2021, we saw the peak of the accumulated victories and the failure which is lived by the Israelis. The resistance was able to unite all the Palestinian people, and that victory was an extension of the victories in Lebanon. Now the Palestinian resistance is at the heart of the resistance front in the region, enforcing new realities.
The Lebanese celebrate May 25th as a national holiday, though the last Israeli soldier left South Lebanon on May 25th, 2000, signaling an end to over 18 years of invasions and occupation of Lebanon. The Lebanese official stance considers the Shabah Farms and Kfar Shuba Hills as Lebanese territory that should be liberated.
Celebration of Liberation Day this year in Lebanon has become intertwined with the victory in Palestine, while Lebanese recall that years of sacrifice and resistance against Israeli occupation led to liberty. They believe it is their duty to motivate the Palestinians to continue on that same path until they reach complete freedom. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The UN Human Rights Council is set to consider an international probe into Israel's abuses in the Gaza Strip as well as the occupied Palestinian territories. The draft resolution presented by Pakistan on behalf of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation will be discussed on Thursday. It calls on the Council to urgently establish an independent international commission to investigate Israeli crimes in the latest round of violence against Palestinians. The text also demands a probe into underlying root causes of recurrent tensions and instability, including systematic discrimination and repression against the people of Palestine. It says the investigation should be focused on gathering evidence that could be used in the future to hold the perpetrators to account. Tel Aviv is also being investigated by the International Criminal Court. The U.S. Secretary of State says Washington will reopen its consulate for Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds, which was closed under former President Donald Trump in 2019. Antony Blinken added that the U.S. opposes any settlement activity, demolitions, evictions, and incitement to violence, highlighting the U.S. support for a two-state solution. Blinken stressed he would notify Congress of the intention to provide $75 million in aid to Palestinians. This would be a top of $5.5 million in immediate disaster assistance for Gaza and about $32 million for the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. Blinken made the remarks after meeting Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas in Ramallah. He, however, reiterated support for Israel against the retaliatory attacks by Hamas, insisting that the Palestinian resistance group must not benefit from the aid allocated to Gaza. Britain, France, Germany, Italy, and the United States have denounced Syria's upcoming presidential election, claiming the vote would be neither free nor fair. In a joint statement, foreign ministers of the Western countries said Syria's May 26th election is not within the framework described in the UN Security Council resolutions. They voiced support for Palestinian, or I should say opposition groups, who have condemned the electoral process as illegitimate. Foreign ministers called the vote a fraudulent election that does not represent any progress toward a political settlement. Damascus says the election is a sovereign Syrian affair and that only Syrians have the final word in the matter. On Saturday, expatriates and refugees started the election, crowding polling stations in Syria's embassies throughout the world, including in London and Paris. Political commentator Faraz Najim says it is hypocritical on the part of the Western countries to criticize Syria for holding an election while the same countries supported terrorist groups in the Arab country.
Very clear that the Western governments and regimes, they are not really fair when they deal with the Middle East, especially, and the systems there. I mean, they support and they back up, like you said, terrorist organizations, and they disrupted Syria and supported opposition groups that propped up everywhere. And we've seen the outcome, how many terrorist networks happened, and how many people were flying over from all these Western governments and other countries to create such, you know, barbaric groups that actually started to, you know, do all kinds of beheadings, killings, tortures, raping, pillaging, stealing, you know, and then they even, you know, expanded to Iraq, and we seen what Daesh did inside of Iraq and different terrorist groups that came from Syria. So, you know, 10 years of that, and, you know, we would think that the West would actually change the way that they deal with Syria, because they seen they failed miserably and they disrupted the place, and they had thousands and thousands of refugees pour out of Syria, leave their homes and go to nearby countries to come out to the West and die on the way inside boats and so on. I mean, and then at the end of the day, they back up systems such as the Saudi regime or all these tribal systems, and they don't speak about human rights with these regimes that they establish and they support and they strengthen as well.
And the U.S. activists and protesters denouncing police brutality against colored people are marking the first anniversary of the murder of African-American George Floyd, a death that sparked global indignation over racism and growing calls for police reform.
As anti-racism activists, Black Lives Matter demonstrators, and U.S. officials marked the killing of George Floyd with memorial events and marches around the country, the members of the victim's family met with President Joe Biden.
This is the 1 year to remember my brother George, and today is the day that he set the world in a rage, and people realize what's going on in America, and we all said enough is enough. We need to be able to set standard procedures in place.
In New York, civil rights activist Reverend Al Sharpton and several other officials, including the city's mayor Bill de Blasio, gathered and kneeled in a symbolic move to remember the black man's murder.
As we want to dramatize to the world the insensitivity and outright total lack of any concern that this officer had, he put his knee on the neck of George Floyd for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. And you've got to have a lot of disregard for the law, disregard for human being, to have something throbbing under you that long.
During the memorial, de Blasio slammed the persistent U.S. police brutality and racism.
How do you forget someone's humanity? Well, because for 400 years in this country, the persistent, obsessive training was to tell white people not to value black lives. It was everywhere you turned. And it poisoned the mind of that officer. What he did disgusts me to this hour of this day.
More than 150 years after the 13th Amendment abolished slavery in the U.S., opinion polls show most American adults believe the legacy of slavery continues to have an impact on the position of black people in society. Following the murder of Floyd, Americans and people around the world ramped up calls to root out law enforcement misconduct and violence against black people. After a year, the divided U.S. Congress still struggles to find a compromise to pass a federal bill in response to the ongoing controversial methods of policing. The 46-year-old Floyd was killed in Minneapolis by white former officer Derek Chauvin, who was convicted last month of murder. While the conviction of Chauvin, who faces up to 40 years in prison, marked a new chapter in the U.S., incidents of similar nature have nevertheless persisted in the country ever since. A year after the brutal murder, activists say measures taken by some jurisdictions, which have been on the books for years, are insufficient to address the issue of systematic racism in the U.S. criminal justice system.
While activists are expressing deep concern over the UK government's treatment of immigrant communities, who they say are often deported unlawfully without a fair hearing and under the most inhumane of circumstances. A London correspondent, Richard Sedan, has more.
The UK Home Office is under the spotlight once more after Home Secretary Priti Patel oversaw an immigration raid under the guise of observing the implementation of the law, but which nonetheless outraged many.
There are other ways to uphold the rule of law and the practices and policies and rules and regulations of any government without sensationalizing the misery of people who are extremely marginalized, excluded, and many of which have, you know, traveled an awful long way to seek the safety and international protection of the United Kingdom.
In Scotland, despite hundreds turning out to prevent a similar immigration bust, Priti Patel reiterated that she believed British people supported and voted for such scenes.
The Home Secretary is completely delusional. I don't think there was ever a vote that said, do you agree to people being rounded up like cattle, denied their right to appeal, denied an opportunity for their family members to be informed that they have been rounded up, and to be deported or administratively removed from the United Kingdom.
The Windrush scandal also continues as part of the hostile environment to affect many people.
There are one and two and three generations of people being denied services, people being denied access to university places, people not being able to access medical treatments, denied opportunities to access social housing, and it is an absolute blight on this government.
Many people think that modern Britain is simply a far cry from the welcoming image which is often presented to the world.
The hostile environment created by the UK government continues to have a devastating impact on communities, with legal experts concerned about many cases of unlawful detainments and deportation. Richard Sudam, London.
All right, that's about it for me.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
The long-standing reality of Palestinians facing violence and eviction, living under occupation and blockade, denied the right to move, and being killed by Israeli regime settlers, police, and military forces, that's all considered normal in official Washington, says Phyllis Bennis, author, in an article titled "Difference between Biden and Trump on Palestine policy is rhetorical." Stay tuned for the details, please. So, Joss, what is the Biden administration's policy towards the Israeli regime? Why did Biden take so long to respond to the violence as it spiraled out of control in Al-Quds and Gaza? Why do Biden's repeated "Israel has the right of self-defense" litanies so closely match the positions of his predecessor, despite the wide disparity between Biden and Trump policies on so many other issues? Throughout his campaign and the first month in office, President Biden made his main priorities clear: the pandemic and the economic crisis it created. People across the U.S. are suffering, and Biden's first tier of importance has been to deal with those intersecting crises. That makes a lot of sense, but there are consequences. Foreign policy, for one, gets virtually no priority. And transforming U.S. policy toward the Israeli regime, Palestine, not on the agenda at all. Biden has yet to even appoint an ambassador to the occupied territories and waited nearly a week into the current crisis to send a special envoy. There have been no meaningful policy shifts so far, only some effort to supplant Trump's hardline language. Even then, Biden's team only slowly, even reluctantly, began to respond to the violent escalation of the Israeli regime's treatment of Palestinians across occupied East Al-Quds and the West Bank, and especially in its air war against the Gaza Strip. The administration seemed to want to hold on to their operative position that it will just have to wait, until suddenly it couldn't wait because the escalation of violence veered out of control. The long-standing reality of Palestinians facing violence and eviction, living under occupation and blockade, denied the right to move, and being killed by Israeli regime settlers, police, and military forces, that's all considered normal in official Washington. But when Israelis were suddenly threatened with the primitive rockets from Gaza, that turned it into a crisis. During a briefing in the first days of the crisis, journalists pushed back against White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki's familiar statement that the Israeli regime has the right to self-defense. They asked whether Palestinians have the same right, but while she had said in other circumstances that Palestinians and Israelis deserve equal measures of freedom, security, dignity, and prosperity, she had to twist herself into a verbal pretzel to avoid saying the words she had clearly been ordered not to say, that Palestinians also have the right of self-defense. Despite hints and claims to the contrary, the Biden administration does have a policy in place on Palestine. The rest of his policy so far preserves Trump's recognition of Al-Quds as the sole and undivided capital of the fake regime of Israel. It includes keeping the U.S. Embassy in Al-Quds in violation of international law and UN resolutions. And it maintains the false claim that settlements are not illegal, paving the way for the Zionist regime annexation of huge swathes of West Bank territory. Nor has the Biden administration issued a word of criticism regarding the Israeli regime's 2018 nation-state law that states that only Jews, no other citizens of the occupied territories, have the right of self-determination in this fake regime. Those policies sound pretty extreme, and they are. They violate international law, they defy long-standing U.S. diplomatic practice, and they guarantee permanent oppression of Palestinians. Beyond helping to end the devastation underway in Gaza, Biden could, in a minute, transform U.S. policy towards Palestinians to one that actually reflects the human rights he claims are central to his foreign policy. He could announce the U.S. Embassy is leaving Al-Quds to return to Tel Aviv. He could acknowledge the clear reality that settlements are illegal and that annexation is an unacceptable act of further colonial expropriation.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and here is food for thought for you today in the form of a beautiful saying from the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. Exchange visits, treat each other mercifully, give each other and do not be like the hypocrites who say what they do not do.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: صاحب السلطان كراكب الأسد، يغبط بموقعه وهو أعلم بموضعه.
Imam Ali stated, the holder of authority is like the rider on a lion. He is envied for his position, but he well knows his position. Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, the son of Abu Talib, alayhi salam. One of the great lessons which we learn from Imam Ali, alayhi salam, again deals with the idea of giving charity. Charity or alms, sadaqah, is something which is highly, highly recommended in Islam. And matter of fact, it is said that charity averts many kinds of afflictions, trials, and hardships. Now, an individual by the name of Mujahid reports that Allah of the Almighty prohibited the people from consulting the Holy Prophet without giving charity before the consultation. Now, a little bit of a backdrop into the situation. The people would just constantly come and bother the Holy Prophet, meaning they didn't have any real reasons to come and consult him. They just did so in order to tease and bother and try to frustrate the Holy Prophet. And so Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Allah the Mighty, the Exalted, revealed a verse that requested the people to give something in charity before they come and consult the Holy Prophet, so that only those people who really sincerely wanted to ask something from the Holy Prophet would come and ask. Interestingly, following the revelation of this verse, no one ended up coming and consulting with the Holy Prophet because nobody wanted to give charity, because nobody, or at least the majority of the people, didn't have sincere intentions. And so who is going to pay charity every single time you go to consult the Prophet? Everyone except Imam Ali alayhi salam. Imam Ali alayhi salam would give charity, and after giving one dinar in charity, he would go and then consult or request or ask the Holy Prophet a question. Now, later on, this verse was abrogated and the permission was given to the people. Imam Ali alayhi salam said, there is a verse in the Holy Quran that no one but me has acted upon. And this is in chapter 58, verse number 12. O you who believe, when you consult the apostle, then offer something in charity before your consultation. Imam Ali says, Allah Almighty discharged this ummah of a duty because of me, for if I didn't act according to that verse, it would remain valid forever while no one could act upon it, that is to offer charity when they wish to consult the Messenger of Allah. Therefore, it was I who removed the heavy burden from the shoulders of this ummah. I am the true proof of this verse, which is not applicable to anyone before or after me. Again, very quickly, the importance of charity and how charity is something which strengthens the society. It strengthens humanity. When we help the poor, when we help the needy, when we help the oppressed, we are in reality helping ourselves. Because by helping the weak and the poor and the needy and the oppressed, we strengthen society, and a strong society is to the benefit of every single one of us. A beautiful lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم إني أسألك الأمان يوم لا ينفع مال ولا بنون إلا من أتى الله بقلب سليم.
O Allah, I ask you for the protection on the day when property will not avail. Nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil. Ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger. Protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks, so they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet. For protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I'm Atta, the producer of the program To My Brother, and at this moment I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Fayyaz Jafar. I hope you enjoy it.
These days, when we turn on our TVs, or are listening to talk radio, or browsing through social media, we are bombarded with unique images of destruction, of vilification, and of the oppression and the isolation of a wide variety of different minority groups across this world. In a country like the United States, there are upwards of 100,000 homeless people. There are people within our own communities who are victims of domestic and sexual violence every single day. There are children in Yemen who are being killed for no other reason other than the fact that they live in that nation. Oftentimes, we see so many images and we hear such horrific anecdotes that in reality, it actually has the potential to desensitize us to the fact that everything that we're seeing in reality seemingly so far away from us that there's not much in reality that we can ever do. Which is why these days when we hear certain images, or when we hear certain stories, or when we hear about certain anecdotes, we are so desensitized toward the violence that we're hearing, that we're seeing, that we're discussing on a day-to-day basis, that within a couple of moments we'll just turn the channel, we'll just close the link and open up another one into checking the score of our favorite sports team without any real regard without demonstrating any real compassion and mercy toward people or victims of oppression. And when we go toward the whole Quran and the teachings of Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salatu was-salam, we see such strong emphasis in terms of the Imams of Ahlul Bayt advising their followers and their companions toward making certain stands in order to creating changes within the society that they were living in.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
In the heat of the deadly Israeli offensive in Gaza, the United States of America repeatedly blocked a UN Security Council joint statement calling for an immediate ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. At the same time, US President Joe Biden gave no signs of plans to step up public pressure on the regime. Instead, he and his administration constantly underlined what they called Israel's right to defend itself. Washington's unwavering support for Tel Aviv is not something new, but has existed for decades thanks to pro-Israeli political and PR influence. Former US President Harry Truman was the first world leader to recognize Israel when the regime was created in 1948, and US aid to Israel began then with small grants and expanded a little over the next decade to include export-import bank loans, food for peace aid, and general economic loans. But Washington's unequivocal support came just after Israel defeated the armies of Egypt, Syria, and Jordan, and occupied the rest of historical Palestine, as well as some territory from Syria and Egypt. Since then, the Americans have always supported Israel to maintain its military superiority in the region and prevent acts against it by Arab nations. Right now, the Israeli regime is the largest cumulative recipient of U.S. foreign aid in the post-World War II era. According to the U.S. Congressional Research Service, Israel has received $146 billion of U.S. taxpayers' money as of November 2020. From 1971 until 2007, the bulk of these funds was fundamental in helping Israel establish a strong economic base. Between 1973 and 1991, $460 million of U.S. funds was allocated to resettling Jews in Israel.
Many of these new settlers are now those who occupy the West Bank illegal settlements. Under the guise of charitable donations, tens of millions of dollars are regularly sent to Israel in the form of tax-deductible gifts for Jewish settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, according to the New York Times. Much of the money, falsely promoted as donations for educational and religious purposes, often finds its way to funding and buying houses for illegal settlers, as well as guard dogs, bulletproof vests, rifle scopes, and vehicles to secure illegal Jewish outposts deep in occupied Palestinian areas. Since then, most of the money has been allotted for military purposes, including the security of Israel's illegal settlement enterprise.
It is important for America's national security to ensure that we have a safe and secure Israel, one that can defend itself.
In 2016, the U.S. promised even more aid. Then President Barack Obama signed the biggest military assistance agreement with Israel ever made by the U.S.
Today, we're making another unprecedented commitment to the security of Israel and the Israeli people. Like any discussion between friends, these talks have had their shares of twists and turns. But I think the end result speaks for itself. The Memorandum of Understanding we'll be signing shortly commits to providing Israel $38 billion in military aid over 10 years, including $33 billion in foreign military financing funds and an unprecedented commitment of $5 billion for missile defense. This marks a significant increase over our existing funding, and it will ensure that Israel has the support it needs to defend itself by itself, and to preserve its qualitative military edge. This is the single largest pledge of military assistance to any country in U.S. history.
In December 2016, Israel became the first after the United States to receive the U.S.-built F-35 stealth jet to enhance its Air Force's ability. According to official congressional documents, the U.S. also may approve additional sales of the F-35 fighter jet and accelerate delivery of KC-46A refueling and transport aircraft. Quite often, U.S. money ends up in the Israeli government coffers under false pretenses. For example, the latest stimulus package includes $50 million to fund the Nita M. Lowy Middle East Partnership for Peace Funds, supposedly to provide investments in people-to-people exchanges and economic cooperation between Israelis and Palestinians, with the goal of supporting a negotiated, sustainable two-state solution. Most of this money is not included in the official U.S. aid packages to Israel and therefore receives little scrutiny, let alone media coverage. The mounting death toll from Israel's campaign of airstrikes against Gaza has thrust U.S. military assistance to the regime into the spotlight. A small group of Democrats now call for conditions to be placed on the several billions of dollars Washington gives Israel each year.
I want to read something a mother named Iman in Gaza wrote 2 days ago. She said, quote, "Tonight I put the kids to sleep in our bedroom so that when we die together." And no one would live to mourn the loss of another one. The statement broke me a little more because of my country's policies and funding will deny this mother's right to see children live, her own children live, without fear and to grow old without painful trauma and violence. We must condition aid to Israel on compliance with international human rights and end the apartheid. We must, with no hesitation, demand that our country recognize the unconditional support of Israel has enabled the erasure of Palestinian life and the denial of the rights of millions of refugees.
While unemployment and poverty levels in the U.S. have skyrocketed as a result of repeated lockdowns, Washington still provides Israel with $3.3 billion in military assistance and $500 million for U.S.-Israel missile cooperation.
We have a responsibility to conduct oversight over our government's foreign policy and what happens with the millions of dollars we send in aid. So I would encourage my colleagues to visit, meet with the people we were going to meet with, see the things we were going to see.
Apart from these new voices, support for Israel is considered a bipartisan priority and for decades has been perceived as the most stable item on the U.S. foreign policy agenda. The mere questioning of how Israel uses the funds, whether military aid is being actively used to sustain its illegal occupation of Palestine, finance illegal settlements, fund annexation of Palestinian land, or violate Palestinian human rights is a major taboo.
I ask for the U.S. to stop aiding Israel, because if Israel is getting this power from the U.S., then nothing will change. There will always be violence. There will always be killing. There will always be this continuation of, like you know, just hatred amongst people.
So the next step is on the American government. In my opinion, they're completely complicit with the $3.8 billion in military aid they give to Israel every year. The American government could leverage that aid to have them end the blockade on Gaza immediately.
Despite increasing protests against U.S. aid provided to Israel, Washington still insists on serving as the regime's main benefactor. It's hard to imagine if Israel could afford the heavy economic burden of continuing their occupation of neighboring Arab lands, such as the costs of maintaining the military forces in the territories, the construction of illegal settlements, and the expanded infrastructure to bypass autonomous Palestinian population centers without U.S. financial support. It's even harder to imagine if the regime could survive without generous aid coming straight from American taxpayers' pockets.
IRIB English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to IRIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
Black American workers have been hit hardest by the pandemic. They are more likely to lose income because of COVID-related layoffs and shutdowns. And by last August, 5 months into the pandemic, black unemployment was nearly double that of white unemployment. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Tanya Wallace Govern writer. This article is published under the heading Black Workers in U.S. Cannot Afford Another Lost Decade. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Black American workers have been hit hardest by the coronavirus pandemic. They're more likely to lose income because of COVID-related layoffs and shutdowns. And by last August, 5 months into the pandemic, black unemployment was nearly double that of white unemployment. But the impact is not just economic. They are 3 times more likely to be exposed to COVID-19 on the job and twice as likely to die from the virus. To recover from the devastating effects that COVID-19 has had on all communities, they must center the concerns and needs of black workers in the economic recovery to come. It's a moral imperative, but it also makes good fiscal and political sense too. The National Black Workers Center has published a new report outlining how federal, state, and local governments can finally place black workers at the center of an economic recovery that works for everyone. They recommend investing in immediate relief and job creation in black communities, protecting workers and eliminating discrimination in the workplace, promoting equal pay and establishing and strengthening offices that protect workers. The U.S. job growth is sluggish, not because workers are counting on government checks, but because U.S. political leaders have yet to address the root causes of work shortages during coronavirus pandemic, including a childcare crisis and workplaces that are especially unsafe for black workers and other workers of color. Until Congress and state leaders take the challenges on, they will continue to need direct payments, which for many working families can be the difference between having essentials for being forced to decide between food, utilities, or transportation. Even before the pandemic, returning to a community after incarceration was challenging because of policies that block people with arrest or conviction records from securing housing, employment, and government assistance. Securing these necessities became even more difficult last year amid uncoordinated releases from jails and prison to ease overcrowding, resulting in even less time for formerly incarcerated people to make COVID-safe living arrangements or enroll for the public benefits they qualify for. Even black workers who do not have these experiences are vulnerable to workplace discrimination in the best circumstances and became even more vulnerable during COVID. Earlier this year, One Fair Wage released a groundbreaking report on the subminimum tipped wage that revealed how the coronavirus pandemic was making untenable work conditions even worse for black service workers. According to the recent report of One Fair Wage, black workers were more likely to be retaliated against with lower tips due to enforcing COVID safety measures. 76% of black workers reported